Hi, this is the October 2024 edition of Junior Scholastic Magazine. I'm Chris Radio Volunteer, Kathy Danaher. On the cover of the October issue, we see a picture of four different brightly colored chocolate bar wrappers. And the message on these wrappers spells out, "Is this the end of chocolate?" Failed crops in Africa are limiting the world's chocolate supply. What does that mean for your favorite chocolate treat? Let's turn the page. And we begin first with an article in Geography titled Sheep City. The photo on pages 2 and 3 shows a huge crowd of people smiling and taking pictures with their phones of thousands of sheep as they are herded through the streets of Madrid, Spain. They're back! Every October, the usual big city bustle of Madrid, Spain, gives way to different sounds. Hooves clatter, bells clang, spectators hoot and cheer. That's because thousands of bleating sheep, along with some goats, cattle, and oxen, parade through the capital city streets. This is Madrid's Fiesta de la Transhumancia, Festival of the Migration. Since 1994, the celebration has honored a Spanish tradition that goes back centuries. Shepherds moving their flocks from mountain pastures in northern Spain to warmer regions in the country's south for the winter. The ancient route went through Madrid, which long ago was more country than city. The modern event is a major party. A group of shepherds leads the way, singing and playing music. Some of them dress in traditional outfits, women wearing long skirts, men in vests and berets, and both decked out in colorful shawls and scarves. Vendors sell food and souvenirs, while onlookers snap photos and try to pet the sheep. "It's amazing," a visitor from the Netherlands told a reporter at last year's festival. "So many people are joining and enjoying it." Next, on page 4, U.S. and World News under the heading of Health features an article titled, "What's on the Menu?" Check out three big changes coming to school cafeterias. The food in your cafeteria may be getting a mini makeover starting this year. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, recently announced new rules for school lunches and breakfasts. The changes limit added sugars and expand the type of foods that can be served. The rules started to take effect this past summer, although schools will have until the 2027-2028 school year to fully implement them. Take a closer look at what the new rules mean for you. Number 1. There will be more vegetarian options. Beans for breakfast? Yup. Cafeterias can now offer a wider variety of protein choices early in the day. That includes providing alternatives to meat, such as beans, lentils, and tofu. Number 2. Hold the sugar and the salt. Chocolate milk isn't going away, but the updated standards lower the amount of added sugars allowed in flavored milk and other products, such as cereal and yogurt. Schools will also have to cut down on sodium, a mineral in salt. Number 3. Honoring traditions. Schools serving mostly American Indian and Native Alaskan students can incorporate traditional indigenous foods. They can dish up vegetables such as sweet potatoes, breadfruit, and prairie turnips in place of bread, pasta, and other grains. The rule also applies to schools in Hawaii and Guam, a U.S. island territory in the Pacific Ocean. Did you know this fact? 28.6 million is the number of students who eat school lunch daily. On page 5, the article at the top of the page is, "Would you climb this ladder?" Imagine scaling a 120-step ladder, dangling some 2,591 feet in the air. That's the challenge facing thrill seekers who visit the small village of Loen, Norway. Loen overlooks a fjord, a long, narrow waterway bordered by steep cliffs. Norway is home to more than 1,000 fjords, which were carved by giant glaciers long ago. The new ladder, called Steigl, lets visitors reach dizzying heights above the fjord. The climb starts partway up Mount Hoven, a mountain in Loen. From there, people scale the ladder, hung at a 45-degree angle, to the peak. But the journey isn't for the faint of heart, says Per Helge Boe. He helped design the ladder. As you step up each rung, he explains, your legs might tremble a bit with excitement and a touch of nervousness. To the top right of this article is a photo of climbers in Loen, Norway, securely attached to a cable as they make their way up the ladder. On the bottom of page 5, the second article is under the heading of Paleontology, and it is titled Teen Rex. And we see a cartoon drawing of a purple Tyrannosaurus Rex wearing sneakers, headphones, and sporting a pair of sunglasses. Kids in North Dakota have found one of the world's oldest teenagers, a young Tyrannosaurus Rex. Brothers Jessen and Liam Fisher and their cousin Caden Madsen were hunting for fossils in 2022 when they spotted bones poking out of a rock. The bones turned out to be part of a young T-Rex. Paleontologists at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science in Colorado recently announced the find. They say the dinosaur was likely between 13 and 15 years old when it died. Only a handful of juvenile T-Rex skeletons have ever been found. Nicknamed Teen Rex, the dino roamed some 67 million years ago. Scientists hope to learn more about how T-Rex grew and whether this one belonged to a new species. Jessen, Liam, and Caden helped excavate the skeleton. Jessen, 12, wants to be a paleontologist. It's been a lifelong dream of mine, he says. On the bottom of the page is a small photo of Liam, Jessen, and Caden. The article that begins on page 6 under U.S. News and Civics is titled, Let Us Vote. Teens across the United States are on a mission to lower the voting age. Learn why and how their efforts could impact you. Nathaniel Esubantang felt determined as he approached the podium at his community city council meeting this past winter. The high school student from Newark, New Jersey, wanted a say in how his local school board is run, and this was his chance to make his voice heard. School board members have a hand in everything, from what students are served for lunch to the type of classes they are taught. But for decades, only Newark residents ages 18 and older have had a voice in electing members. Nathaniel and other young teens didn't think that was fair. In a brief but impassioned speech, Nathaniel urged the city's leaders to lower the voting age to 16 for Newark school board elections. We're at school 8 hours a day with no real input into things that are happening there, says Nathaniel, age 17. I want young people to have a seat at the table, to have more control over their futures and the decisions being made about their education. In the United States, the voting age for all federal elections and most local and state elections is 18. But a growing number of 16 and 17-year-olds across the country have been pushing for the right to cast ballots, some of these teens have been at the forefront of environmental marches, protests against gun violence, and other demonstrations. Many are also politically active on social media and want a chance to express their opinions at the polls. Teens see that people like them matter to our communities and democracy, says Abby Kisa. She is a researcher who studies youth voting trends at the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University in Massachusetts. These dynamics may motivate youth to find ways to have a voice in their community, such as through voting. The voting age for federal elections has been 18 since 1971. That means you have to be at least that old to vote for president, vice president, and members of the U.S. Congress. But cities and states have control over their own elections. They can set their voting age, as long as it isn't higher than 18, for positions such as mayor, city council member, and other local offices. The first U.S. city to lower its voting age to 16 was Tacoma Park, Maryland. In 2013, lawmakers there gave 16 and 17-year-olds the right to cast ballots in local elections after a number of teens in the town lobbied for voting rights. Since receiving that right, young people in Tacoma Park have voted at higher rates than all registered voters. During the city's 2022 election, 63% of registered 16 and 17-year-olds voted, compared with 49% of all registered voters. Tacoma Park's success has inspired other teens nationwide. In 2015, young people helped form a national group, Vote 16 USA, to coordinate similar teen-led efforts to lower the voting age in communities across the country. And over the past several years, they have had some success. 16 and 17-year-olds have won the right to vote in a number of other U.S. cities and towns, including Riverdale Park, Maryland in 2018 and Brattleboro, Vermont in 2023. Teens in Culver City, California hope their community will be next. They have their own branch of Vote 16 USA called Vote 16 Culver City. When this issue went to press, members of Vote 16 Culver City were collecting signatures on a petition calling for a measure to be included on the ballot in next month's election. That measure would let voters decide whether 16 and 17-year-olds should be allowed to vote in local elections. The last time such a measure appeared on a Culver City ballot in 2022, it lost by just 16 votes. Julia Rottenberg, who was president of the Vote 16 Culver City until she graduated from high school this past spring, says the loss just motivated the group more. Each individual voice really does matter and can make a difference in the community, the 18-year-old says. Obviously, change is hard, but if the work wasn't hard, it wouldn't be as important. Devon Lawson, 17, knows about hard work. The teen from Finn Rock, Oregon, has volunteered on roughly 25 political campaigns since he was in the fifth grade. When Devon was in middle school, he heard about teens in other parts of the country trying to gain the right to vote. That inspired him to act. He decided to try writing a bill to amend Oregon's constitution to allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in local and state elections. In 2022, Devon teamed up with State Representative Robert Nose. The lawmaker worked with him on drafting the bill and eventually helped introduce it in the Oregon legislature. The bill stalled last year, which means it didn't advance. But Devon isn't giving up, as some lawmakers consider reintroducing the bill next year. He's working to gather even more support in his state for a lower voting age. For Devon, being able to vote is about having a say in critical issues that his generation will inherit, such as climate change. He said he does not want to wait until he's 18 for his opinion to count. 16 and 17-year-olds are part of a politically active generation, Devon told reporters. We can make informed decisions on the ballot. However, many people are against the idea of lowering the voting age. Critics say the majority of 16 and 17-year-olds don't know enough about the issues, about how the government works, to be informed voters. Others point to scientific findings showing that 16-year-olds' brains and their decision-making skills aren't fully developed. This has led many states to actually raise the age that teens are allowed to do certain things. For example, to drive without restrictions in most states, you have to be 17 or 18. Only a few decades ago, the age was 16 in many places. John Cosgrove is a former state senator in Virginia, where there have been recent teen-led efforts to lower the voting age. I think 18 is a reasonable age to vote, he told reporters. That's when a person is considered an adult. They can join the military, they can do a lot of different things, but 16 and 17-year-olds are still minors. Still, supporters of lowering the voting age say teens deserve a voice. They point out that 16 and 17-year-olds who work pay taxes on their wages, just like adults do. What's more, many teens are currently enrolled in high school government and civics classes, where they are studying how elections work. People in favor of allowing younger teens to cast ballots say it would help them put what they're learning in the classroom to use in the real world. That was a big motivator for DJ Yearwood of Kansas City, Missouri. He's on a mission to lower the voting age in his state for city and school board elections. Last year, he founded a branch of Vote 16 USA. That organization, Vote 16MO, is made up of 150 student volunteers across Missouri. DJ says that allowing 16 and 17-year-olds to cast ballots in local elections will help motivate them to vote in federal elections when they are older. Several studies show that the earlier in life people vote for the first time, the likelier voting is to become a lifelong habit. Once teens have that ability to vote, and if they're able to begin voting while they're still learning about civics in school, they'll be more likely to seek out information themselves and keep voting, the 18-year-old says. Back in Newark, teens are ready to start voting. Earlier this year, the city council voted unanimously to lower the voting age to 16 for school board elections. The decision was thanks in part to input from Nathaniel and other young people. The historic move makes Newark, with a population of more than 300,000 people, the largest community in the United States to expand voting rights to young people in more than 50 years. When this issue went to press, Newark election officials were programming the city's voting registration machines to allow roughly 7,000 16 and 17-year-olds to enroll. That's how many young teens will be eligible to vote in the city's school board election next spring. In the meantime, teens like Nathaniel and his friend Brianna Campbell are working to mobilize as many local 16 and 17-year-olds as possible to exercise their new right. Both students are members of the GEM Project, an organization in Newark that works to engage young people in community service efforts. Along with other GEM Project members, they are volunteering at voter registration drives and hoping to organize events where teens can learn more about the candidates. Brianna, 17, believes school board members need to prioritize more mental health services for students. She says she's extra motivated to cast her first ballot. Voting is more than civic duty, she says. It's a powerful way to shape the world around us and make our democracy more vibrant and inclusive. On page 7, 8, 9, and 10 are photos of each of the teens who are mentioned in the article. And they're all working with lawmakers to lower the voting age in several states. On page 11, under Economics and World News, the article is titled, "The High Price of Chocolate. Your favorite candies are getting more expensive. What's behind the increase? And will the cost continue to rise?" The photo on page 11 shows a variety of chocolate candy scattered around and falling out of a striped bag. The candies are shaped like dollar signs and chocolate coins. Milk chocolate bars, peanut butter cups, caramel-filled wafers. It might be hard to imagine a world without these sweet treats. But cocoa, the main ingredient needed for chocolate, is in short supply. Nearly 60% of the world's cocoa is grown in two countries in Africa, Côte d'Ivoire and Ghana. Extreme weather and other conditions in those countries have devastated harvests in recent years. That has significantly shrunk the global cocoa supply. The financial effects are being felt around the world. With less cocoa available, the ingredient has gotten more expensive. Global cocoa prices hit a new high this year. What does that mean for chocolate lovers around the world? Decadent cakes, gooey candy bars, and fudgy brownies are a far cry from where chocolate begins. Cocoa comes from cacao trees. These trees thrive only in hot tropical climates close to the equator, including parts of Africa, Asia, Central America, and South America. Cacao trees are highly sensitive to changes in temperature and rainfall. Even in the best conditions, they can take 3 or more years to produce their first harvest. Extreme weather due to climate change makes cocoa farming even harder. In 2023, West Africa received record amounts of rainfall. The cocoa-producing areas in Côte d'Ivoire had their highest total precipitation in more than 20 years, according to the former data firm Grow Intelligence. That excess rain hurt the cocoa harvest. This year, the farmers have had the opposite problem. Droughts in West Africa are the second worst in more than 10 years. In addition, plant diseases are killing the cacao trees. As a result, cocoa production has decreased over the past 3 harvesting seasons by 467,000 metric tons in Côte d'Ivoire and by 448,000 metric tons in Ghana. 1 metric ton is equal to about 2,200 pounds. Despite the cocoa shrinking supply, consumers haven't given up their love of chocolate. U.S. customers spent $25.9 billion on the sweet treat in 2023, compared with $19.2 billion spent on non-chocolate candy. When goods or services are in high demand but in short supply, whoever is selling them often raises prices. This is known as the law of supply and demand. The U.S. retail chocolate prices have increased 10% in the past year and are projected to keep rising, economists say. We're at the mercy of a key ingredient that can really see a lot of variation in price, especially when there are problems with the environment, says Melanie Marks, She is a chocolate economics expert in Virginia. But what's the most you would pay for chocolate? Companies know there's only so much they can charge without losing customers, so they have other workarounds. Some are shrinking package sizes. Others are pushing candies with less chocolate. The new chocolate frosted donut Kit Kat, for example, is dipped in chocolate, but only on one side. Some companies are trying to boost their product's chocolate taste with artificial flavor. Does your favorite candy's label say chocolate or chocolate flavor? To call it chocolate, at least 10% of the candy's weight must be cocoa, according to U.S. food regulations. Is there anything that can be done to boost the cocoa supply? Farmers in Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana are trying to plant more cacao trees, but it's a slow process. Once you have trouble with your cacao fields, it's hard to get them to bounce back, Mark said. A few companies are looking into new ways to grow cocoa. One business called California Cultured is using plant cells to grow cocoa in large indoor tanks. The company's aim is to one day grow cocoa indoors on a much faster timescale, in days rather than years. Meanwhile, WinWin, a firm based in the United Kingdom, is one of several companies developing cocoa-free chocolate. WinWin is using plant ingredients to mimic chocolate's taste and texture. The products are pricier than the chocolate brands most people are used to, for now. That could change as people spend more time developing chocolate alternatives, especially if cocoa availability drops further, says Alma Bazares Calderon. She teaches economics at Pitzer College in California. We're going to see that substitutes are going to become cheaper, Calderon says. I expect that's going to happen, not so long from now. On page 14, under Geography, the world's deadliest ocean route. Roaring winds, fierce storms, 65-foot waves. Would you sail through the Drake Passage? The photo on page 14 shows rough waves tossing a boat under a dark gray, stormy sky, clouds all over, as it sails with difficulty through the Drake Passage, a stretch of ocean that has claimed thousands of lives. Cian Byrne, 14, sits by a window at a cruise ship dinner table. As he gazes out at the dark, churning sea, his eyes grow wide with fear, but also excitement. Gigantic waves, one after the other, crash into the window, inches away from him. The force of the raging sea rocks the ship up and down like a roller coaster. Other passengers shriek, and Cian grabs his water glass to keep it from spilling. But the teen from Los Angeles, California, doesn't panic. He knows this is all part of the experience, sailing the infamous Drake Passage. The Drake Passage is a 600-mile wide waterway between South America and the Antarctic Peninsula. It is located where the Atlantic, Pacific, and Southern oceans meet. Scientists and explorers have long described the Drake Passage as one of the most dangerous voyages on Earth. Ship crews have reported waves as high as 65 feet, some of the tallest in the world, and an estimated 10,000 sailors have died in shipwrecks there throughout history. However, the Drake Passage's danger hasn't dampened its appeal for travelers. More and more people are braving the journey and posting about it on social media. When this issue went to press, a TikTok video of Cian's experience this past March had already 80 million views. Sion and others say the wild ride is worth it for what awaits on the other side. A chance to see the ice-covered continent of Antarctica. The first European to sail the Drake Passage may have been Francisco de Hoces, a Spanish sea captain, in 1525. Adventure seekers, scientists, and regular travelers have been drawn to the region ever since. Even noted explorer Ernest Shackleton crossed the Drake Passage in 1916. Shackleton is known for his historic attempts to become the first person to reach the South Pole, Earth's southernmost point. When his third attempt failed, he had to sail across the Drake Passage in a tiny lifeboat to rescue his crew, who were stranded on a nearby island. He braved hurricane-force winds on the journey. Journalist Alfred Lansing wrote a book about that voyage. He described Shackleton's route across the Drake Passage as the most dreaded bit of ocean on the globe. One reason the Drake Passage is so turbulent is its location. Rough weather at sea is usually weakened when it reaches the land. But the center of the Drake Passage lies at about the 60 degrees south latitude line. There is hardly any land in this latitude anywhere on Earth. This means that at 60 degrees south latitude, storms and winds can hurtle around the globe without anything to slow them down. The Drake Passage is also known for its intense water speed, some of the world's strongest and fastest moving ocean currents surge there. Today, TikTokers call a rough trip through the Drake Passage a Drake Shake. A smoother journey is known as a Drake Lake. But regardless of the weather, the two-day voyage is far safer now than it was in Shackleton's day. Modern vessels that cross the Drake Passage are built to do so, ship captains say. They have highly accurate weather forecasting technologies that allow them to avoid the worst storms. The ships are also equipped with advanced stabilization systems. These features reduce rocking, vibrations, and other impacts from ocean waves. As Sion learned about these safety features, he started to feel more comfortable on his journey, despite the rough waters. He says he would sail through the Drake Passage again for the chance to return to Antarctica. "I was a little nervous on the ship," Sion says, "but this was probably one of the best and most memorable trips I've ever taken." And on page 15, the article under True Teens of U.S. History is called Standing Up for Justice. During the Great Depression, Mexican-American workers faced discrimination and dangerous working conditions. Emma Tanayuka helped them fight for their rights. On page 15, we see a picture of Emma and a line of workers holding up protest signs whose cause for better working conditions she helped to support. As 13-year-old Emma Tanayuka made her way through a crowded park, worries filled her mind. It was a sunny afternoon in 1930, but a shadow had fallen on her hometown of San Antonio, Texas. Emma had been coming to Lively Plaza del Zacate since she was a little girl. She enjoyed gathering at the park with the rest of the city's large Mexican-American community. Vendors sold hot tamales while festive accordion music filled the air. New arrivals from Mexico filled in local residents on the latest news from across the border. Today, however, the atmosphere was tense. Emma saw fear etched on people's faces. They spoke in hushed tones about money struggles. The United States had recently fallen into the Great Depression from 1929 to 1939, a period of severe financial hardship. During the Depression, thousands of banks shut down. Many people lost their life savings. At the same time, nearly 25% of America's workforce lost their jobs. Families struggled to support themselves. Even before the Depression, Mexican Americans endured severe discrimination. They made less money than white workers who did the same jobs. Their children went to inferior schools. The Depression was making these inequalities worse. The injustices made Emma angry and sad. Who is going to help? She wondered. That day in the park, Emma felt powerless, but she would soon find her voice, becoming a fierce advocate for her community. Emma was born on December 21, 1916, in San Antonio. Her family had deep Tejano roots. Their ancestors could be traced to Spain and the native peoples of Mexico and Texas. Emma's parents eventually had 11 children. There wasn't enough money or space for everyone. So, at a young age, Emma was sent to live with her grandparents. At the time, San Antonio, like much of the country, was deeply segregated or separated by race and ethnicity. 40% of the city's residents were of Mexican descent. Most lived on the west side of the city. Many dwelled in shacks with dirt floors and no indoor plumbing. Emma grew up on the west side, but in comfortable conditions. Her grandfather, Francisco Zepeda, earned a good living as a carpenter. But his true passion was politics. He believed in racial equality and voted for candidates who shared that view. His beliefs shaped young Emma. On Sundays, Zepeda took Emma to Plaza del Zacate for ice cream. They listened to activists discuss religious freedom, workers' rights, and other causes. Those afternoons inspired Emma for the rest of her life. "My grandfather was the one who really influenced me more than anything else," she later said, "because I loved him so much." Still, there was no way to avoid prejudice in San Antonio. Like housing, schools and eateries were segregated. Emma once saw a restaurant owner deny service to a group of Mexican students because of their ethnicity. "You had things like that happening all the time," she recalled later. During the Depression, such mistreatment became even more obvious. When work became scarce, white Americans blamed people of Mexican descent. They wrongly believed immigrants had taken all the jobs. Some of that anger turned into threats and violence. At the same time, federal programs were set up to help provide struggling Americans with money, food, and jobs. But people of Mexican descent were often left out, says Maria A. Ramirez. She is a historian at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. "Emma saw those in her community face discrimination," says Ramirez. "I think that might have been one of the harshest effects of the Depression on her." Emma entered high school in the early 1930s. Despite the upheaval around her, she excelled in her classes. She joined the debate team and an after-school book club. Club members discussed works by influential thinkers such as Thomas Paine and Karl Marx. Those writers believed in empowering ordinary people. Emma took note. One day, a newspaper article caught her attention. A group of female workers in San Antonio, most of them Mexican American, were planning to strike for better treatment and higher pay. The woman hand-rolled cigars for a local company. They were forbidden from leaving their posts for more than 4 minutes at a time, and they earned only $2 to $7 a week. White women rolling cigars at other companies averaged nearly $17. The situation wasn't unusual. In those days, U.S. factory workers often endured long hours for low wages. People of color were even more vulnerable to mistreatment, particularly women. The article said that a local sheriff had vowed to break up the cigar strike by force if necessary. Emma, 16, decided to go anyway. "I felt there was something that had to be done," she later said. She joined the picket line and was promptly arrested. But Emma had found her calling. After graduating from high school in 1934, she devoted herself to fighting for workers' rights. In the mid-1930s, the Depression showed no signs of letting up, so the U.S. government passed a series of laws to help protect workers. One was the National Labor Relations Act of 1935. It guaranteed people's rights to organize into unions. Those were large groups of workers from the same industry. By uniting, workers had more power. But few of San Antonio's Mexican and Mexican-American workers benefited from the new laws. Their bosses often threatened to get them thrown out of the U.S. if they joined unions. Emma was determined to help those people, especially women. She started knocking on doors and speaking with women workers directly. She encouraged them to stand up for their rights. In 1935, she helped organize local chapters of a female garment workers' union. After that, she joined picket lines, wrote letters, and staged protests to draw attention to unfair conditions. Her work wasn't easy. In addition to prejudice, Emma faced sexism. Many people believed women should stay quiet, not march and chant in the street. When people saw Emma, she often heard them say, "Here comes the little girl who confronts men." Emma's persistence earned her a reputation as a strong leader. People nicknamed her La Pasionaria, or the Passionate One. Local workers often looked to her for help. In early 1938, she was asked to aid some of San Antonio's most mistreated workers, pecan shellers. Pecans were a big business in San Antonio. Trees around the city produced about 50% of Texas's pecan crop, and the state supplied about half of the country's pecans. Most of the city's 12,000 pecan shellers were Mexican-American women. They labored in sheds with no indoor restrooms and little fresh air. Cramped at long tables, the shellers used their fingers to separate the pecan meat from the nuts' shells. And as they worked, pecan dust filled the air and their lungs. Many people blamed the dust for breathing problems. At the time, a contagious lung disease called tuberculosis was common. San Antonio's rate of that illness was 3 times higher than the national average. Shelling pecans was a grueling task, and one that machines could do, but it cost factories less to have people do it. The shellers worked 10-hour shifts every day and took home an average of $2.73 a week. On January 31, 1938, the Southern Pecan Shelling Company announced it was cutting wages. Previously, the shellers had earned 6 or 7 cents per pound of shelled nuts. Now they would get 5 or 6 cents a pound. Upon hearing the news, thousands of shellers walked out in protest, and their union called a strike. The workers reached out to Emma. She agreed to lead them. The strike swelled to 10,000 shellers from several pecan factories. They marched and chanted. They waved signs reading, "This shop unfair." Emma joined them on the front lines. Police used clubs and tear gas on the strikers. More than 700 people were arrested, including Emma. Still, the strike continued until March. That's when both sides agreed to let an independent group step in. The group ruled that the Schellers should be paid higher wages, but the workers' success was short-lived. In October 1938, a new law set the federal minimum wage, the lowest amount people could legally be paid, at 25 cents per hour. Rather than raise Scheller's pay again, the pecan companies replaced 10,000 workers with machines. By the late 1930s, Emma had joined the Communist Party. At that time in the United States, the Communist Party was a political party focused on workers' rights. But anti-communist feelings ran strong in many places, and Emma's work made her a target. After receiving death threats, she fled the city a year after the pecan strike. During the 1940s, Emma left the Communist Party. She lived a quiet life as a teacher in California, moving back to Texas 2 decades later. In the 1980s, historians began to rediscover Emma's story. They recognized her as a pioneering Mexican-American labor organizer. Emma Tenayuca died in San Antonio in 1999 at age 82. Today, the park where she spent happy afternoons with her grandfather has a prominent marker honoring her life. And around the city, colorful murals celebrate her achievements. Meanwhile, the pecan strike is now considered an important early action in the Mexican-American struggle for justice. In 1983, an interviewer asked Emma whether she was ever scared to stand up for her community. "I never thought in terms of fear," she answered. "I thought in terms of justice." On page 22, the last article is entitled, "Should You Be Able to Shop Without an Adult?" Some shopping centers around the country now require teens to have an adult chaperone. Is that fair? And on the top of the page is a photo of four young teens smiling and walking together with friends through the mall. It's Saturday evening, and you can't wait to head to the mall to shop, grab a bite to eat, and hang out with your friends. But someone else may be tagging along too, your mom. A growing number of stores and malls across the United States are requiring that minors be accompanied by an adult, especially on weekend afternoons and evenings. Some restaurants and amusement parks have adopted similar policies. Business owners say the rules are being added in response to fights and other unruly behavior by teens. Earlier this year, Del Amo Fashion Center in Torrance, California, began mandating that teens have an adult chaperone after 3 p.m. on Fridays and Saturdays. Mall employees under 18, however, are allowed to work without an adult accompanying them. Supporters of such rules say they keep shoppers safe and teens out of trouble, but opponents argue that the policies unfairly punish teens who haven't done anything wrong. On page 22, the last article in this edition of Junior Scholastic is titled, "Should You Be Able to Shop Without an Adult?" Some shopping centers around the country now require teens to have an adult chaperone. Is that fair? And on the top of the page is a photo of four young teens smiling and walking together with friends through the mall, and they appear to be having a very good time. It's Saturday evening, and you can't wait to head to the mall to shop, grab a bite to eat, and hang out with your friends. But someone else may be tagging along too, your mom. A growing number of stores and malls across the United States are requiring minors be accompanied by an adult, especially on weekend afternoons and evenings. Some restaurants and amusement parks have adopted similar policies. Business owners say the rules are being added in response to fights and other unruly behavior by teens. Earlier this year, Del Amo Fashion Center in Torrance, California, began mandating that teens have an adult chaperone after 3 p.m. on Fridays and Saturdays. Mall employees under 18, however, are allowed to work without an adult accompanying them. Supporters of such rules say they keep shoppers safe and teens out of trouble, but opponents argue that the policies unfairly punish teens who haven't done anything wrong. What do you think? Read on, then decide for yourself. Nearly 1,000 minors swarmed the Del Amo Mall this past December, reportedly with the goal of destroying property. A huge fight broke out. Law enforcement was called in, and the mall temporarily closed. The brawl, along with previous incidents of theft and violence, prompted Del Amo officials to issue the chaperone policy. Even shopping centers that haven't experienced such extreme disruption have introduced bans. Store officials say the rules help curb troublesome behavior, including vandalism. We strive to provide a safe shopping experience for every visitor, Jean Saturn, an official at the Mall of Louisiana in Baton Rouge, said in a statement. That mall, the largest in Louisiana, have implemented a chaperone policy this past June. It bans unaccompanied minors after 4 p.m. on Fridays and Saturdays. Shopping with an adult can help teens act more responsibly, supporters of the ban say. Research shows that brains don't fully develop until adulthood, which means teens can struggle with decision-making. It can also lead them to engage in risky behavior without thinking through the consequences. Plus, banning unsupervised teens is good for business, some store employees say. Rowdy teens can scare away shoppers. It kind of makes people feel like going back to online ordering, a male shopper in Torrance told a local TV station. But critics say chaperone policies unfairly restrict teens who follow the rules. It's almost a punishment for kids who are responsible, says Suzanne Mohan, a mom of two teens in Woodcliffe Lake, New Jersey. Her family regularly shops at Garden State Plaza in Paramus, the second largest mall in New Jersey. It began requiring chaperones last year. Mohan's seventh grade daughter, Emily, isn't a fan of the policy either. Parents or guardians should be the ones deciding whether their teens are responsible enough to shop on their own, Emily says. It's unfair, she explains. If your adult doesn't trust you, they probably wouldn't let you go to the mall alone. In addition, Emily and others point out that the policies could actually hurt stores by driving away young shoppers. There are about 27.7 million teens in the U.S., making up a large consumer group. Teens, on average, spend about $2,260 per year, according to a survey by Piper Sandler, a financial services company. Mall stores facing competition from online retailers could benefit from those sales. What's more, teens want to socialize with their friends, and malls are one of the few places where they can get a taste of independence, critics of the policy say. 10th grader Amrita Kumar from Demarest, New Jersey, agrees. The first time you go to the mall on your own marks an important moment, she says. You feel the sense of responsibility. In the picture on the top of page 23, we see a teen pop group called the Hanson performing at a mall in 1997. The history connection is mall's teen era. Where did teens used to hang out? Malls. In the 1980s and 1990s especially, young people would spend hours shopping and walking around with friends. Teen-focused retailers like Claire's, Hot Topic, and Wet Seal flourished. Many malls added arcades and even hosted pop concerts. Why might malls have encouraged teens' presence back then? This is good discussion material. And that's all for this installment of Junior Scholastic Magazine. I'm Chris Volunteer, Kathy Danaher. So long, until next month.